Hey, Vanessa.
Hey, Decca. Happy Solar Eclipse Day.
Yes, we are recording this intro on the morning of the eclipse, and I am super excited for this event.
Yep, you're in the path of totality and everything. I'm not, but I'm excited too. I've also been looking into eclipse horoscopes, and they say that now is a time for new beginnings.
Ah, well, that's very true for us.
Yes.
And we do have a little announcement to share, but before that, just a reminder, you're listening to Urban Roots, the podcast that preserves place through story. I'm your host, Dara Hussein Wetzel, a historic preservationist.
And I'm Vanessa Quirk, a cities journalist, and your other co-host. And we have news. Okay, so you ready? Da-da-da-da-da-da!
Yes.
Season 3 is coming!
So we've been working super hard at putting these narrative episodes together, and we really can't wait to share them with you all. Our plan is to start publishing in mid-May and bring you new episodes through early July.
Mm-hmm. Yes. Wish us luck. It's a lot of work. Hopefully we make it. So if you're not subscribed to our podcast or our newsletter, please do so now. And that way you'll know immediately when a new episode drops.
You can find the links to our newsletter and social media in the episode notes. Okay, let's talk about today's guest.
Great. We have none other than Justin Garrett Moore, the program director for the Mellon Foundation's Humanities in Place program. But that's not all he does. Like us, Justin wears a lot of hats. And one of his hats is as an adjunct associate professor at Columbia University.
Mm-hmm. Justin was actually my professor last semester, and I felt super fortunate when he invited us to the Mellon offices to have this conversation.
Yeah, you can definitely hear our excitement in this interview. It's a very high energy one, and it was really fun. And we got to talk about Justin's career path, and we also dove into some of those big thorny questions facing preservation today.
Yeah, and in the second half of the conversation, I asked him to break down the Humanities in Place program to understand why Mellon funds what it does. And if you're a preservation organization, even a small and scrappy one, you'll definitely want to listen.
Yeah. All right. So I think we should just get on into it. Let you get into the eclipse and let's let the good listeners get to our conversation with Justin Garrett Moore.
Oh, you pressed record. Great.
I did.
Excellent.
This is the number one thing to remember as a podcaster. Number one thing.
Number one.
You don't want to know how many times we've accidentally not hit record.
Okay, just going to dive right into it. Could you just tell me who you are and what you do?
As if you don't know. I don't know. Just keep up the mystery.
Yes.
Poor listeners.
I'm Justin Garrett Moore. I always use my middle name. And I'm an architect, urban designer, urban planner, historic preservationist, and generally a person that cares about cities, about people, about communities. And I do all sorts of different things. Whatever the urbanist equivalent of a polymath is, I am.
Renaissance person, I guess.
Yes. Yeah. So I really do have my hands in a lot of different fields and disciplines and sectors. So I now work at the Mellon Foundation. So I work in philanthropy as a program director of a program called Humanities in Place, where we do work related to heritage, culture, placekeeping, and finding all the different ways that people carry their histories, carry their stories, both within their places, the built environment, the places and landscapes, but also through their communities directly, through the people, through the stories, through all the kind of the knowledge and kind of imagination that bring people together to connect their culture.
Awesome. We're kind of imagining the scope of this conversation, the second half being more about Humanities in Place and really digging into what you're doing right now.
Okay.
And we would like to have the first half of the conversation be more a bit of an exploration of you and why you were called to this work and what preservation means to you and the kind of more like big picture themes.
Sure.
So I guess to get us into that vein of questioning, it seems like the through line of all the different things you do is place. There's something grounded in place. What was it that called you, I assume, as a young person, I don't know when exactly, but to do work that was grounded in place?
I think my interest in place did start at a very early age. And it's funny, a couple Christmases ago, I was home visiting parents, and parents keep all kinds of stuff.
Where's home?
Indianapolis, Indiana is where I'm from originally. And, you know, go in the attic, and there's like the folder of these kids' drawings, and there's a drawing that I did. I must have been in maybe second grade or something. And it's a drawing of the Walker Building in Indianapolis. So the Madam C.J. Walker Manufacturing Company, and very long story short.
Our listeners know, should know who Madam Walker is.
They should know. Right. So my mom had an office in that building when I was a little kid. And so it would go after school or whatever, hang out at my office. And so I had this drawing. And like just as a very small child, like the detail of that's the theater marquee and the entrance, and that's where the offices are, and that's where the shops are. And I even have the smoke, the pollution coming out of whatever engine or heating oil was being used in the 80s. Right. Like I was hyper aware of that environment. I even drew this little street sign that said Martin Luther King Boulevard, like that level of detail. So I just was always interested in places and like capturing it and thinking, well, why is this place different from that place?
It's a little act of preservation, actually.
I'll send you the little scan of the drawing.
Oh my God, I love that.
Yeah, that'd be great.
And so, yeah, so like, you know, as a kid, I was aware of these things and other things. So I grew up in Indianapolis in the black part in Meridian Kessler, large forest center city, like it would have been green lined historically, but there was a section of it that was not. And so that was where we grew up. It's growing up, our park or playground didn't exist, right? We had what was called the coal field, which was the state fairgrounds nearby. And there was like a coal storage yard that hadn't been used for a long time, and so we went to that big field, like there was like coal everywhere. So that was our park. And then we would go to different neighborhoods, go to a white neighborhood, and they would have park with grass and swimming pools and play equipment. As a kid, I learned that the place matters, right? The place is very different. How you experience it is very different. Now I had a blast at the coal field, right? But there is an important difference that even as a kid I registered.
And so when did that translate from interest to, oh, maybe there's a career in this?
Mm-hmm. Very interesting story and very unconventional in that my career started very early at 14. Mm-hmm. So I went to high school in Indianapolis, Arlington High School. It's now closed, but it was a probably 95% black, quote unquote, inner city high school. And the superintendent at the time and the principal and all these people had these ideas about providing job opportunities and things for students in the schools. And they had a program where if you had a large contract with the school, you would hire students. And so my high school had a new gymnasium that was being built my freshman year of high school. And there was an architecture firm that had a contract to build that gym. And so I had a full-time 40-hour week summer internship in an architecture firm my freshman year of high school.
That's super neat.
That's yeah. And the thing is, it should be done everywhere.
Yeah.
Honestly, it was a paid internship. So I was making good money at the time. It was like, oh yeah, this is not only is it interesting, but I was clearly motivated to do it and show up. And I learned all sorts of things in that firm because it was a relatively large firm. Of course, did the explicit design and architecture stuff, but we would rotate around, met with the people doing construction administration. We met with the marketing team that is soliciting for new jobs. We would shadow the principals when they were going to the planning boards to present the work to get the zoning variances that they needed to get the project built, right? So I would have been to my first kind of planning meeting as essentially a kid, and not just like there, but like actually knowing what was being talked about, what the impact of the decisions being made. So it was an incredible experience. And many people probably know that there are very few BIPOC, but black specifically, people that are in the architecture and built environment field generally. Mm-hmm. And so that early exposure is important. And I have a pet peeve with all the kind of the quote unquote pipeline, you know, black kids don't know what architecture is. That is just so insulting and insane to me. Like, people know what architecture is. It's that they don't have real opportunities. So it's not go to camp and, oh, you can design buildings. No, pay me to design buildings and you're going to get a different result. So it was great exposure. And so I had very early interest in architecture and went directly from high school into college to study architecture. And that really was my path.
And just maybe for context, I think what helps is because you're a person of color who's gone to the architecture field. Other people of color might listen to this and be like, oh, how does somebody do that? I think hearing about your educational background after high school and how that panned out and how that led you here would be super helpful to contextualize.
Sure. So yeah, so I went, because I had exposure to architects at a very young age, I actually knew all the different kind of dynamics of how one really gets into the field. And as I mentioned in the firm, we had exposure to all the different disciplines and fields.
Yeah. Just probably more than your average first-year architecture student.
Actually. Oh, yeah. Way more.
Yeah.
Oh, yeah. Our first-year architecture is like criminal. It is such a scam. Yeah. Like they don't give you any real actual insight into the field.
And it's so abstract,
it's
right?
So abstract. Yeah. And it's putting you in the path that you're going to be Corbusier or right. Whatever, yeah. Right? Like the design architect and or the one person or the boutique kind of design shop. And that is just not how the field and the industry and the market works like at all. So I have that early exposure to know that there are people that are more technical and do that. I know that there are people that are basically salespeople. I knew that there are people that are doing the kind of the politics and the resource conversation. So I had exposure to that. And I didn't necessarily, I knew I wanted to go into architecture and to built environment fields, but I didn't necessarily be the capital A architect Howard Roark thing. For that reason, I intentionally went to University of Florida, which is a 4+2 architecture school, rather than a 5-year kind of direct path to being a capital A architect school.
So bachelor's to master's.
Bachelor's to master's, yes. So a 4-year bachelor's degree, which is a bachelor of design. So it's not it wasn't an undergraduate architecture degree. It was a design degree that is purposefully set up so that you can go actually into different paths and fields because you learn different things along the way. So we had people that had landscape architecture, interior design, urban planning, and architecture.
Cool. Multidisciplinary.
Multidisciplinary. I had a very early multidisciplinary design education. And that was something I purposely wanted to do. And so after that, I had a path then for graduate school, and I chose to come to Columbia, both as a great design school, but also because it's in a city, because I grew up in a city. I had a difficult time being in Gainesville, Florida, and not in an urban environment for that time, let alone being in the South, which is a whole other story I won't get into. Columbia was an opportunity to come to New York to have great landing and exposure in the design world here, and that was where I had the real exposure into urban design, urbanism, urban practices, as it intersects with all these different fields, including preservation, in a really direct way. And I've just been ingrained in that ever since, that it's not only architecture. Architecture is very core to how I think, what I know, what I'm interested in, but it's as it is connected to all these different disciplines, landscape, preservation, real estate development, public policy, whatever it is that shapes how we live.
Yeah, I felt that's how I always felt. I feel like that's why I got or was drawn to planning, thinking that it was like a multidisciplinary field, and maybe sure a little bit, but like I definitely feel like preservation is way more interdisciplinary.
Oh yeah. Yeah. Out of necessity.
Yeah.
That's interesting. When preservation was brought into your academic work, how was it presented? Was it, because I feel like we've had conversations with people who have had different experiences of what preservation is. Mm-hmm. And for some folks it seems like a very, I guess in a traditional way, there's a very specific thing of what preservation means. How was preservation presented to you in school, and did it square with what you felt like preservation meant from your background or upbringing?
Yeah, so I'll go back to in the undergraduate era, and Florida also did have preservation as well. They had, it was very cool, they had the Nantucket Preservation Institute, and they did a lot of work in Yucatan, like summer programs and things. And so my early exposure was this 6-week program in the Yucatan, Merida, like kind of colonial architecture going back to ancient, and just being really fascinated, interested by like how people build and then the kind of cultural content dimensions of that shows up in the built environment in such different ways.
Merida's on my to-go list. It's really beautiful.
Oh, yeah. It was incredible, wonderful, beautiful learning experience to just see and be connected to all that. But I had that kind of exposure in school. And then in my studios, I had a wonderful professor, Paul Carrioke, who's actually at the time, many people may know Mabel Wilson, very important architect, designer, and scholar. So Mabel and Paul used to have a firm together, Carrick Wilson Architects, and so they were at the time really pushing on a lot of different things. So he was my professor, and Florida has traveling studios, and we had a studio in Savannah, Georgia. And so in that studio, my project was at, and again, I was feeling a certain way at that age, having come from the North and living in the South. So I just noticed all the Confederate monuments. This is 18 or 19-year-old me, as in someone in architecture school doing a project, and mine was about Confederate monuments.
Come full circle now.
So like, I've been doing this for a while. And so we're going around the city, and we're talking about, like, the urbanism, the pattern of Savannah's grid city, and all these things. And so they're like, look at the grids. And I'm like, look at them.
It is hard to not notice them. I'm not even going to lie. Like, the person who went to Richmond, Virginia, I was like, what is this? This is, like, the middle of this major intersection.
It's a lot. And so my design project to design, essentially, the kind of the counter monuments to what was built into landscape for what wasn't told in history, and so to mark the histories of slavery, of course, histories of labor, environmental histories, all those sorts of things, and how do you make that legible in the landscape? And for me, that was a conversation about what was not shown and what was not preserved and what was not embedded in the built environment. What I was doing, what I was processing, the conversations I was having with my professor, the conversations when I would get up and present what I was doing, was my form of engaging this question of what is preserved in the built environment. And people that, and I don't want to go down a tangent about education in Florida, but I had an incredible education at the University of Florida. And what's going on now with DEI and anti-woke laws and all those sorts of things, like, I would not be the person I am and have the exposure that I have, the ability to engage in certain conversations if I hadn't been, you know, at the University of Florida. So I'm really worried about that. But the conversation about women's preservation practice is something I had very, very early in my education.
So when you look at the preservation field today, what do you think are the challenges that it's facing that are perhaps most pressing that it needs to address?
Most pressing challenges in the preservation field today, I think, are threefold. So one is climate, and climate change is real. And preservation practice and discipline, their approach to engaging that question about climate and climate change is in the sort of the kind of technical, what does it take to protect and elevate and problem solve things without actually addressing what is happening and why it's happening and who it's happening to and where it's happening, that needs to be connected to the narrative and the history and story of a place. And so things are really fractured. I think people have just gone into the camps and people are like, we just have to do the technical problem solve thing. Or in opposition, people are like, no, we need to do these other things. And there isn't a good intersection in my view, because it's the field itself is very fractured. So that's one branch. I do think the evolution of the field is also challenged. And people have different career paths into it, but I think the career path is still predominantly people that are from that kind of architecture built environment space. And so they bring with them that orientation. Even the ones that are trying to get away from it, it's still there. And so that's a challenge. And I think preservation as a field, in order to actually do its work and to do its job, does need to be more responsive. So you have those kind of built environment people, and then you have the scholars and historians and academic people, and they also are bringing their baggage into it too. And so you have these two very dominant forces that are missing a big piece of the equation in terms of how this field will continue to be relevant, how it can be most effective for the different communities and spaces that it can and should be operating in, and that it can have some power and agency within. So that's the kind of the people and or the kind of the educational and professional kind of systems that they're a part of. That's a problem. So the first one is kind of, you know, elephant in the room, climate change, then the sort of disciplinary thing. And I think the final piece is that, and it's connected to the second point, which is that a society is completely, and this is a U.S. point, and it's also a global point. Society is completely in crisis mode. So people have a lot of things that are urgent, important, that demand their energy, their attention, their bandwidth, their resources. And because of all of those stresses, whether it's a global political conversation or if it's a very local economic dynamic or kind of crisis point, people don't have a lot of capacity. And so preservation in terms of the hierarchy of needs is pretty low.
Yeah.
And so getting people to connect with and understand the value of that, where and how it lands on what people consider important, is, I think, a really difficult challenge. And I think that preservation as a field just doesn't do a good job of communicating with the public or with the society or with whatever X stakeholder that you want to name or identify, that they see the value and utility of it and that they should engage with it.
Totally.
Woo, I want to unpack all of those.
Right?
Can we spend some minutes?
You're like jotting notes down over there.
Yeah, like a little student. Yeah. I'm like, oh my God. Like, let's go in order since you laid it out so beautifully. You're our professor, so I shouldn't be surprised. Okay, let's start with part one. I guess the climate thing is, I think, very obvious and clear in terms of the issue at hand. But I think the thing you brought up that is even more interesting to me is like the way the field and people are addressing it in this technical fashion instead of the kind of more human-centric way of thinking about the impact of climate change and like you said, who's being affected. And then that being indicative of a greater fracture in the profession. I think that is very interesting. I would like to take a minute just to sit on that because, I don't know, like I feel like as an individual, I fall into this trap a lot. I'm like a problem solver, solution oriented person. And I think anyone who's ever been in a relationship knows if your partner comes to you and is like, oh, I've had a really hard day because of XYZ. And you're like, well, let's see what we can do. Like, we can do this, we can do that. And your partner's just, I just want you to feel bad with me for like 25 minutes to an hour. Is that okay?
Right.
And I feel like it's similar to what's happening. So I was just curious, like, how are your seeing it manifest and what are the impacts of it in the real world?
Mm-hmm. So that is definitely a good sort of explanation of what happens in a lot of communities. And what's important is to then connect it to the resource conversations that happen. There may be resources for the problem solve, right? The kind of the conspicuous, like there's a best practice somewhere, Ecomos or whomever, somebody said something a long time ago that this is how you should fix problems. Mm-hmm. And so there's resources and understanding and kind of support to address things in that way. But the second thing, how do people process and feel and understand what's going on? How are they connected or not? That needs resource and conversation. There isn't a good kind of path and format for that type of work to be engaged or resourced. Everything is set up. It goes to who's on the UNESCO heritage list, right?
Right.
And now they like keep patting themselves in the back. Look at what we put on the heritage list. And it's like, get a grip. There has to be a releveling and to say, okay, there's been a significant amount of resource put into developing these solutions, resourcing these approaches, and not a lot here. And so there just has to be a resource shift that says, okay, we need to talk about how are people adapting to a significant loss, or a repeated loss, or a loss that happened a long time ago that they're still sitting and living with that has still not been addressed. There has to be a major shift in terms of bandwidth and attention to make that space legible so that you can actually deal with the climate issues in a more kind of complete way.
Doug, I'd love for you to also answer this question from your perspective and your experience in the field.
Well, I mean, I think that like the reason that people out in the public get interested in the preservation stories because of a particular story, right? Mm-hmm. So even if it's like a news journalistic thing where they're like, this building's about to be demolished, it's going to be lost, we need to save it now, people's attention gets grabbed onto that. But in a more
like the kind of things you and I do kind of way, like the three of us here. Storytelling becomes about making people interested in what had happened. And Urban Roots podcast is like, you know, our narrative stories are not like one type of story. So we'll sometimes talk about Biddy Mason or Madam C.J. Walker, who are two really amazing African-American women, because I think that when people hear their stories, they're like, oh, this boss black woman did this? Whoa, there must be more stories like that out there. And so originally I thought we were just going to be doing stuff like that. And then Indianapolis, the episodes that we did with Indianapolis with Urban Legacy Lands Initiative, everybody in our feed should really know who they are by now if they've been listening. And then our episodes became very like place preservation centric, as in like there, even if there's erasure, we find ways to honor the story. Like what we do with Vanport Mosaic in Oregon, in Portland, Oregon area, Vanport is gone. And now they've been collecting oral histories for 10 years and then are working with us to do a podcast episode, because that's almost just like another step in trying to make sure that this information's out there and that people hear this stuff. The other importance is that with especially erasure and displacement, these stories are repeated over time, like through policy. Like,
absolutely.
But we don't really get to focus back on like how to do some good with it until, honestly, like groups like the Mellon Foundation funds a lot of these types of projects, right? So I think that's also really important to the conversation, which we might have to come back to, because I think there's like a part two and three to the other follow-up. But yeah, that's really like why I think it's about equitable preservation-based development. It's about storytelling. It's about all these things. And I think that is something pretty cool about like seeing a group like fund all of these different things, right? There's a lot of people out there who have buildings that need to be preserved. But that's one aspect of trying to preserve. But also it becomes hard to compete for money.
Yeah, and the thing about an important piece of the storytelling piece is that narrative power is incredibly instrumental in how the world is shaped, right? A very long time ago, a pope said in a script that people of African descent, black people, dark, brown, whatever people, are inferior, and it's a word, it's a narrative, it's a story that then gets activated and propagated, and it transforms
deeply
everything.
Deeply embedded into culture and general awareness.
So, like, it's a story that has shaped so many things, right?
Right.
The Manifest Destiny or Jefferson's Grid, whatever it is, there's some kind of narrative power that becomes very real. Very real in terms of resource, in terms of all sorts of things. So we talk about the problem solver, the technical thing, as being oppositional to the narrative. They're actually just on a loop, and they're equally instrumental tools. That again, to me, it's such a bizarre fracture in the discipline that it turns into that. But people, I think, really need to understand how instrumental both are, and the lack of balance for people that have a lot of narrative power, which tend to be people whose communities are of race, and they do the work of carrying the stories generation to generation with whatever means they have, whether it's oral or in their body. Like, there's some people, it's like, how do you know that? And it's like, I know. Oh, well, it's not documented. It's like, so what? I still know. Guess what? But there's a power dynamic that sort of diminishes that for a purpose, because people know that narrative power is actually quite powerful.
Do you think it's changing in the field? Do you think it's starting to? I mean, obviously we're biased, because I see someone like Deco who starts a podcast because you see the need in your preservation work. But do you see it changing?
Yeah, I mean, joked about before with UNESCO. Like, yes, it's changing that they're trying.
Yeah,
they're trying to do something. They acknowledge that there's a shift and that there's some work needs to be done. But the question is, the change done in a balanced in an effective way, or is it done in a purposefully marginalized and incremental way? So that, I think that's a big question.
I think some of that gets to your point in thinking about the levels of where these particular groups that get to ascribe value onto heritage places. Man, this is really me pulling out these things that I'm really diving into here at Columbia. I'm not even going to lie. You're talking about also like international level, like heritage preservation, and then there's state level preservation, and then there's local. I mean, there are so many disparate levels. It's intertwined. It's so confusing. And I think that also becomes part of the problem. In some ways, you think about it maybe as, in a way, gatekeeping, right? And I think considering that there are nonprofits and groups out there that are really taking a lot of action to do this work. They need resources, right?
I did want to quickly do a quick tangent on, on the point that you were making about the international frame in the conversation. And another kind of anecdote. So when I was in graduate school at Columbia, so moved to New York, and there was no LinkedIn or anything like that. So there was a poster like on the door. It said, get a part-time job working for Bernard Schumi Architects. And like you had to, like, you know, pull the little number, like they cut them and pull the number off. So anyway, I worked at Bernard Schumi's office and...
Literally someone from Bernard Schumi put on the poster? Because I think that's like when you're selling your couch, right?
Yeah.
That's great.
It's very, very old school.
Love it.
Yeah, things are so different now. But so I worked in his office and the project I was working on, I'm very biased, but he's a great architect. So the project I was working on was the new Acropolis Museum. So this is where in Athens and in Greece, there has been a forever fight over the Parthenon marbles, which are in the British Museum. Mm. And the British Museum had, back to the narrative point, so an international kind of conversation about provenance. And in 1970, whatever, people got together and said, here's the rules for whether something belongs to you or not. Hmm. Right. And certain people were in those rooms to make those rules. And those certain people said that the British Museum gets to keep its stolen Greek. The marbles literally from the freaking Parthenon in the British Museum, right? And so the people writing the rules, it determined narrative. Again, it's a narrative, right? That these belong to us because they were acquired in XYZ by a certain date. And so it's all a fabricated narrative by the British Empire. And another narrative was layered on top of that international law legal narrative, which is that the British Museum was capable of maintaining and preserving and caring adequately for this global heritage asset for the world, and that Greece was not. Hmm. They didn't have an adequate museum. So this is like...
Was this also when it was like the recession time? Because Greece had a very big economic downturn.
No, this has been like a conversation for a very long time. But like Britain has always had more money than Greece because... Mm-hmm.
I wonder what that
is. Right. And so there was an argument made saying that you don't have a space. And so Greece said, okay, fine. So they built an entire museum. They hired one of the best architects in the world. And they built an entire museum. Mm. And the museum was... So I'm in an architecture firm. We were designing a museum for stolen objects. Like, that was like the... project.
In Greece, too.
In Greece, yeah,
right?
In Athens.
Like, yeah.
So they, really and cool. The Greek government said, okay, you said, we'll call your bluff. They built that museum. It's a beautiful museum. And the top floor is a kind of a gallery that's in alignment with the actual Parthenon and a space for the marbles to return. Uh-huh. Wow. And to this day, those marbles still are in the British Museum.
Oh.
So I just wanted to return back to that point about the conversation about narrative and power. And so, the rules changed, right?
Yeah.
Because, that was the argument there. You just need an adequate place and then we'll return them to you.
Mm. Yeah. So it's like, who is creating these rules?
Yeah.
And
who
it's true.
Is creating the rules? Right. So I just wanted to return that point because I think it's an important one because it is one that we have to press on. And there have been a lot of conversations about provenance, like, you know, returning the Benin bronzes or all sorts of things. And that is connected to when you mention these different layers of government. So what the international community agrees to versus at the national level, at local level, who's determining significance and value and who's determining what level of information is required in order for something to be defended as being valuable and protected by either organization or state or law or practice.
Yeah, I'm thinking. I was just in Santiago, Chile, where I lived for a few years. And I went back and I took the time to go to the Cementerio General, which is the national cemetery in Santiago. And I walked around it with this gentleman who's for like over a decade just been like calling the alarm, like, this cemetery is falling apart. It's falling apart. This is our patrimony. So much of what was important to our heritage is falling apart. And it's caught in this bureaucratic nonsense where the the neighborhood, which is a very poor neighborhood, if we're calling it, like, we can compare it to, like, the Bronx of New York. Like, this is not the midtown of New York.
It's like,
and the neighborhood says it's not our responsibility. It's, like, the National Heritage Organization, whatever, and the National Heritage Organization, no, it's your responsibility. And they just keep putting up their hands and passing the buck. And and every year it's, like, mostly fall down. It's an earthquake-prone country. Things and now, unfortunately, robberies have started happening. People are stealing from the graves and stealing the bronze. Because Chile is in a very difficult situation economically, but at the same time, it's like there's not enough care. And when you get into these limbos, there's always people on the ground that are like trying to get the word out, and it's just like it feels like there's no one listening or no one paying attention or no one giving the resources to help them. And that is, I think, the most frustrating thing in this field.
Vanessa has been there before and has talked to this gentleman before.
Yeah.
And I'm curious, was it just worse off preservation-wise? Yeah.
I lived there in 2014 was when I left, and I had seen it, and it's in much worse condition than the last time.
And this guy still is doing all this stuff, not getting paid doing it. Like, he's just doing it.
And the climate thing makes it worse, right? Like, weather extremes and all that, like, things degrade even faster than they used to.
Yeah, oh, my gosh.
There's so much need. There's so many communities. There is a bit of a segue, actually, because I think we were talking, you said the second issue facing preservation today is this, the evolution of the field and where people are coming from.
Right.
And I think there it seems from my perspective as an outsider that there is a bit of a tension with credentials maybe in the field, and the need for people to have like maybe academic degrees when there are a lot of people out there doing the work on the ground who may or may not have degrees but are preservationists.
Absolutely.
And we're doing work with like Black Arts Conservators. Mm-hmm. This is one of their like big things. There are so many conservators and preservationists out there that don't get acknowledged as such.
Right.
Do you think that's also ripe for change in the industry, or does that feel like a harder one to change because of like the entrenched systems for what it means to be a preservationist?
Yeah, I think that's an important thing to flag. And I would say professionally, the thing that I'm most aligned with is Urban Designer, which has no association and it has no credential.
Interesting.
There's no letters you can put behind your name that say that makes you an urban designer. Doesn't exist. And coincidentally, when you look at urban design as a field, it's a lot more diverse. When you look at all the built environment disciplines put together, urban design as a field is more diverse, multidisciplinary, reflective of the society than any one of the other disciplines that have the letters. Mm-hmm. So in preservation, I think you're right, like the core of preservation, right, is people with the letters. You get the professional letters or the academic letters.
Mm-hmm.
And both of those systems were gatekept fields and disciplines and was purposeful. I mean, both in terms of race, but also class, that are in both of those spaces that is still foundational. So in the opportunity for preservation to open up and say, okay, you don't really need the letters. You don't need RA, AIA, whatever, you don't need PhD necessarily to be a preservationist. And that has borne out, and there are lots of people doing very important, valid work in the field, in practice. They have a body of work without having either of those things. And I think the more that grows and becomes conspicuous, but also becomes elevated to be as important as the people with the RAs and the PhDs, I think the field can really open up quite a bit. So I do hope that happens. Obviously, the preservation schools are working on, I think they are legitimately working on that. So some have looked at who they're sourcing and bringing into the schools to get the kind of the master's degree. So that's an easier lift than professional licensure and or pure academic scholarship. But I think there's a lot more work that can be done. And I think the field itself can acknowledge practice in the way that the art field or other fields are able to have pathways for people to advance and have power and agency and legibility without being tied to either an academic institution and or a professional body.
I hope so, because I feel like in arts and like which doesn't require, shouldn't require an MFA, for example. I feel like that's become a thing recently, which is...
Recently, yeah.
And I'm not one to talk because I have a master's in journalism. Who needs a master's in journalism? That's not a... It doesn't
apparently everybody
thing.
Who writes in journalism. Right, just
because they don't seem to be they seem to be something people do want, right? That's the thing. Yeah.
The society broadly has channeled people that way.
Yeah, and why did I do it? Because everyone said it's actually not... You're not getting a master's with the... Like, the letters aren't about the education, it's about the network.
The network, right.
Which is, I guess, it is in itself problematic, but it's like, what are you, if you have access to it, are you supposed to take advantage of it? Or are you supposed to not because you want, this is, I guess, always a
all grapple with it when we are in these types of settings and when we meet new people. You've lived in New York for so long. I'm just here coming here fresh into New York and like just the opportunity to be able to chat with people who are
to be
doing great things.
In the Mellon Foundation with Justin Garrett is actually this is like a big deal. So many people in the nation in the world would never get this opportunity. It's because you're in New York City because
you're in New York. Absolutely. You
know? I'm amongst people who are architects, journalists, designers, like Mabel Wilson referenced her earlier. So it's that. For me, it's like people shouldn't have to be going for a PhD to be able to learn from great people too at the same time. But also y'all are busy and y'all are really smart, right? You're incredibly smart. So it would make a lot of sense to say, let's bring these people in as either full-time faculty, adjunct faculty, even print legs teachers at, Penn.
Yeah. And I think also like with media and that's partly like anyone can listen to this podcast. And also with the people we're trying to talk to, part of what we're trying to do is find the people on the ground, the unsung heroes doing the work. And I would imagine you feel similarly with the work of the people you're funding. It's like there are unsung people doing so much work, dedicating so much time and energy. And in your case, it's like financial resources. You can give them your way. In our case, it's like storytelling resources. And we can help them tell their story, hopefully. That's what we're trying to do. And bring attention. And that's what motivates us to do the work we do. Because we feel like the more attention we have, the more we can bring attention to other folks and hopefully like help move the movement forward.
That and there is, I think, zero place in like the history podcasting space for actual urban history storytelling like we do it. I truly think that's what can transform like the public perception of what we do every day.
And I think there's one of the groups we fund is called Scowwag Magazine. And they're from the journalism space, but we see them as doing really essential core preservation work.
What do they do?
They're a magazine that covers the South generally, and a lot of a range of issues. So everything from the mass incarceration of black people in the South, issues with food and environmental justice. But they also have a conversation about what is the history of place of these people and of these communities, and how does that get carried and made legible to those communities, but the broader society, because it's really that gap between the broader society not actually knowing its history by design, very intentionally and increasingly nefariously, like that people purposely do not know the history. And so they don't have control of what is allowed to be in the 11th grade textbook, but they have this platform, which is kind of online journalism, that they're able to say, okay, how do we create a space to allow people to tell their stories that probably isn't in the column of scholarship that has been hyper vetted, that then it can end up in something like a school textbook, but it is still a true, accurate, and complete part of the history that needs a vehicle to reach the society, right? So that is preservation work for people to know what happened in that place, to know what that place was historically, to know and to be able to look around you right now and to understand the layers of that place and what has shaped it is preservation work. And that's happening through the channel of, in that organization's case, of journalism.
It's probably hard to ask this question without, it's hard to be unbiased, but what are some of these other organizations that you feel are inspiring to just this ultimate goal of storytelling and preservation, but framing it more towards equity and something that's like long term, right? And impactful.
So there's one group called Egan Euphilegia. These are Muscogee and Creek people that throughout history have been displaced, Trail of Tears, et cetera, to Great Plains, so places like Kansas and Oklahoma, and the communities that were originally from what we would say is Alabama or Georgia, Florida, et cetera, had been moved to completely different climate, completely different place. And so these communities were, extant communities were in these places, and they were trying to hold their language because their language was their way of holding their knowledge and holding their history. Like, you could only accurately tell their history in the native Muskogee language, right? And it got to the point where there weren't enough people to actually speak the language to, and so therefore the history is being lost. So there is essentially a language preservation project that was connected to the idea of a place preservation project. So what they did is they had a group of elders and community members go back to the original homelands and find the place that resonated, and they did all the fundraising, did whatever it is they needed to do to acquire that place. They now have 2,000 acres of original footprint and homeland in central Alabama, and they have started building a place to actually preserve and maintain their culture through language, through returning their what were their traditional ways of life that they could teach across the generations, and to actually shape the place in a way that reflects their history, and to have control and agency and power over what that looks like, both as a preservation project, but then acknowledging that the world is very different from then, and doing the work to translate and adapt that for the people in the population today. Mm-hmm. And so it's incredibly powerful that they've literally done the work of kind of reworld building as a way to preserve their history, heritage, culture, and language, all kind of in one project. Wow. So that one is an incredible example of like how different it can be, and that is their preservation project.
Yeah.
And so just to understand from your perspective, like, why it's emblematic of the kind of project that you want to put resources behind, that you feel like is where, like, aligns with the values of your foundation and everything, is it because of all the different threads that it's pulling together into one, like, geographic location? Is that kind of part of what makes it so fundamental a match?
Yeah, so one that it is place-based, it is anchored to the space in a way that has a kind of a power and agency that is a response and reaction to what happened in their history, right? Their place was taken away from them in history, and this project is to counter that and attempt to rebalance it. So that's one thread. I think the other thread is about a power conversation, a power control conversation. So there, I can't even count how many museums, universities, big institutions where, especially in the post-2020 world, where it's, we care about Black and brown people and indigenous people now, and we're going to do a thing, and we're going to put some stuff up on the wall, we're going to have a program or activity, and yeah, we know this is important and valuable. Actually, not doing it, right? Because A, you're coming here to get outside resources. You're not using your own resources to do that. You're asking other people to give you the resources to do something you should be doing yourself. Mm. B, the idea that it's a whole people's heritage, history, culture is something that happened in the past. It's in a box. It's in a container. It's very limited. And it is an adequate response to say we did an exhibit or we did a program is so offensive. It's wild. And you actually sit back and think, now it's crazy offensive. So this type of a project where it's, they're not putting something up on a wall and in a box and do a documentary film about it. They're like, this is a way of life of how the pattern for how we use the earth and inhabit it should exist. And it should not be a footnote or something on your wall. Mm. We're living. We still exist. Right. I think there's a really important kind of anchoring there, and that's probably because of the particular distinct history of indigenous people, and in this specific case, the Muscogee Creek people has a very particular history, but a lot of the people in the communities we're working with have exactly that resistance to being flattened to a footnote.
And I think that even has me considering the geographic locations. A lot of it might come from a specific place where a group is trying to do something very direct with a mm-hmm. geographical area. Mm-hmm. But then I'm also thinking about organizations that do things in a more national capacity scale, mm-hmm. right? Those, I was wondering if you could give us an example of one of those, just so we have one of mm-hmm. maybe each.
Yeah, sure. We have the New York City LGBT sites. So that's a project that we support and fund. And so, as the name says, they've done a lot of work in New York. So finding places, events, activities, histories that are connected to LGBTQIA community in New York, and providing like the resources to document that and to make it accessible to wider public, but also doing a certain level of work and research that can help sites get into like a conventional path around designation, et cetera, mm-hmm. et cetera. But the work that we supported with them was actually to be a network resource for other communities nationally, because, you know, New York obviously has a certain degree of resource and sure. and sure. connectivity and acceptance yeah, yep. and all of that, then, you know, that doesn't really exist in other parts in the country or not at the scale that is really warranted. And so they're working as a hub network and a resource for other smaller communities to be able to access their approaches, mm-hmm. Have the kind of the guidance and assistance to support work in places that would they never would have the kind of wherewithal and capacity that's there. And so they're operating actually as a national conversation.
Is this from some of the work that started from Andrew Dolkart?
Yes, absolutely.
Okay, for context, Andrew's another person who's a professor at Columbia. He focuses a lot on architectural history for LGBTQ plus sites. And I was familiar with that in the New York capacity. And am actually really excited to hear more about how the national work is being done. And I think just going back to fundraising, you work with the Humanities of Place program. There's a number of other programs that Mellon has. So could you explain what is that? What do you do with this program? How does it all work?
Sure. So the first step is that the Mellon Foundation is the largest funder of the arts, humanities, and culture in the U.S. Obviously, there's like the federal government and lots of different sort of tentacles of that. But in terms of being a single funder, Mellon is the largest. And so it is more traditional form of philanthropy. So there is a large endowment left by the descendants of Andrew W. Mellon, right? So there's a kind of a fortune that was made at some point that was dedicated to specifically funding this type of work. So the National Gallery of Art was the gift of Andrew Mellon, right? So the foundation has this very long legacy. So founded in 1969 was sort of the consolidation. And it was associated with supporting universities, libraries, museums that were doing work related to arts, humanities, and culture generally. So that's Mellon's role at this stage in American society, economy, culture, et cetera. So that's been there for a long time. We've always cared about our history, our culture, how it informs and shapes and reflects our society is integrated into the history of the foundation. The current president of the foundation, that's Dr. Elizabeth Alexander, came to Mellon in 2018 as sort of new leadership and had a vision to really press and challenge, okay, what does it mean to do that work in today's society? And the kind of overarching banner was that a social justice explicit framework for how arts, humanities, culture, and all the different things that Mellon was already connected to and very grounded in, that shift needed to happen. The program that I lead, which is called Humanities in Place, is the first new program area at the foundation in over 30 years. Mm-hmm. And its explicit purpose is to really be a pretty defined tool or instrument for the foundation advancing its social justice mission while being connected and rooted to our work, which is to support the humanities broadly. So what that means and looks like, so there are parts of the foundation that fund things like universities, like the Higher Learning Program. So if you're a scholar, historian that's doing work to find out the complexities and generate new knowledge about our history, heritage, culture in the framework of a university space, you go to Higher Learning. If you're an artist or an arts institution that is wanting to develop and create new work and programs that express our culture, informed by XYZ, there's a space for that. Humanities in Place, as the name in place says, is how does this work happen in places and communities directly, right? With the public, in a public sphere, in a public realm, and also generated from and by people directly in a community to also have the agency and access and kind of utility of everything that the humanities, arts, and culture can provide in addressing these social justice needs. So I was recruited to come in as the first lead of that program, and as has come out in the conversation, I have a direct background in place work. Mm-hmm. So architecture, built environment planning, community development, preservation. I have the kind of the smorgasbord of backgrounds to say, okay, what does it look like? Like literally, what would it mean for the humanities to happen in place and in a community? Mm-hmm. So that's the framework that was established. So our program.
May I interrupt slightly? Sure. Because it makes a lot of sense. I get why Mellon Foundation hired you. It makes a lot of, like, why wouldn't they? You have the perfect background for it. But why did you say yes to them? Because you had a lot of, I would imagine you had a lot of options. You had a long career already doing really interesting projects. You could have gone a bunch of different directions. Why did you say yes to this position?
Yeah, that's interesting. So I was brought in late 2020 during the pandemic following Black Lives Matter post-George Floyd protests. And I initially was not interested at all in philanthropy.
Oh, okay.
like even, you know, back in grad school, I had a wonderful, one of my favorite educational experiences ever. I took a course with Andreas Huson at Columbia in a Mellon-funded seminar in grad school called Globalizing City Cultures, like changed my life. I spent an entire semester studying monuments with Andreas Huson in grad school. So I knew Mellon. I had very positive associations and everything with Mellon. But I worked in government. I was a civil servant, 16 years, very direct. There is no question who you work for when you work in government. You work for the people.
Right.
And yes, politicians are there. But in New York City government, your responsibility is crystal clear. And philanthropy, in my experiences with philanthropy and all that, like it is a different space. So I was skeptical of philanthropy, honestly. Mm. I was sort of recruited into the role, and I had the mix of skills and backgrounds, as you mentioned. And it wasn't until I was able to have like a more direct conversation with Elizabeth, the president of the foundation, say, what is this about? What are you really doing? What is really the space and opportunity going to be? Because if this is just about giving money to elite people and fancy people that think they're doing a great thing. I just was not interested in that at all.
Yeah.
Not at all.
Yeah, I get that.
And there's a part of Mellon that is that. On full transparency, this is a very, there are a lot of very smart, exceptionally talented people, both here in the foundation and within the work that we support. It's wild sometimes, honestly, in a cool way, but also in a little bit scary way sometimes.
Right.
There is operating at that level, and I love that stuff and want to operate at a level, but I was not interested in not being directly responsible to what I call the multitude, right? If you're not responsible actually to the multitude and you're working at a certain register, then you're not doing work in my view. But she was able to convince me that, no, that was really what the interest is. And after joining coming here, we have been able to do that. A lot of our work, you know, yes, we have MacArthur geniuses and elite universities and institutions that we work with, but we also have little ladies from a block at Dingle College. We also have people that have been working in coalition for multiple generations and having no success in their communities.
Right.
So that balance, it is within this program there. And I think with Elizabeth's leadership, and this kind of goes all the way to conversations with the board, conversations operationally, both within and outside of the foundation, that we can center and value that conversation about who are we actually supporting, where do the resource actually land and go when we talk about quote-unquote social justice framework in our grant making.
What's the hardest decision you've had to make? Because I would imagine that almost every person or organization that comes to you asking for resources in some way, form or fashion deserves. So these are not easy decisions that you're making. And I'm wondering, is there a moment that you remember that was one of the hardest things to decide, like what to say yes or no to?
Yeah. Mellon has a lot of resources, but we don't have infinite resources, so we have to say no a lot.
Yeah.
And I would say that the hard no's are often, and this is a very long conversation, are about when we cannot fund just general maintenance.
Ah, this is a very good answer. Keep going. Yes.
And it's a very difficult conversation. And anybody who knows anything about me, like I have a whole thing about maintenance and care and how the world would just be very different if there were a way to reframe that conversation. I saw it when I was in city government. So when I was in New York City government, the head of the Public Design Commission, we oversaw $10 billion a year of capital projects. So the design of $10 billion a year in capital projects. So New York City is just constantly being rebuilt. And so there's a ton of money that goes into building things. And it is almost impossible to get money committed to care for, repair, and maintain things. It is just so bananas to me, and I just, like, the everything everywhere would be so different. This goes into our public health system. I mean, it goes into everything that there's something weird about how humans are wired, or at least humans operating in the system of capitalism are wired, that creates a problem here. If I had my druthers and more money to spend and all that, I would certainly think about how that, and not just that we would give money for people just to, for maintenance funds and things, but like how we would have a smarter way to engage that question for how under-resourced communities in particular can be set up for the ability to actually care for and maintain their places in a longer arc.
Right.
Than we're able, in our current framework, we're able to help someone save something or restore it or preserve it or to create something new that acknowledges a history and to hopefully set them up to do that work in a way that is generally sustainable. But we're not able to have a targeted conversation about care, maintenance, and preservation. And our colleagues in the public knowledge program, so the public knowledge program here at Mellon is responsible for libraries and archives. There is a crisis with archives, right? A lot is being lost, whether it's from just literal deferred maintenance kind of considerations to changes in technology, so like different kind of generations of recorded media, information being lost from certain types of degradation. So there's a huge issue that needs to be addressed. And so every case when that comes up and we are having to say no, it's tough.
A quick clarification question. When you say not able to fund maintenance and maybe repair, is that rehab? Is that like capital?
We fund tons of capital projects. So we fund lots of like preservation, restoration, building stabilization. We'd fund tons of that. So let's say we've got a stabilized building and we want to make it now a usable space. It's programmed and actable. We'll fund that. Mm-hmm. So everything's done. It's pretty. The ribbon cutting's there. You had your first event. It looks nice and pretty and everything. We would not fund. We got to keep the lights on. Or we know that we need in funds to be able to keep this place.
Right. Like the operations and the things like that.
Conventional maintenance and operations. Which sense. Large institutions, right, they have endowment funds. Sure. Or they have business and revenue models that factor all of that in. Typically, the organizations we're supporting and the places that they're working, they're not able to rent out their space 10 days a year for $50,000 to get the maintenance money because they're in a community where you can't do that, right? You know, so a fancy museum, right? They can do that and they can generate they have all sorts of business models for that. The people we're working with, that math doesn't work for them.
Do you also do organizational funding, right?
Both. Okay. Yeah, both. Yeah.
Maybe it would be great for you to give us an example of an organization that's been funded that I think is just a good example of something that really hits the mission.
Well, here in New York, we've funded purely the organization itself, a group called the American Indian Community House. So this is a pan-Indigenous group here in New York, connected with multiple Indigenous groups and tribes in the region, so not necessarily Lenape, but all sorts of different Indigenous groups, which include diaspora Indigenous groups, so Taino, et cetera, that have a footprint here in New York. And so this organization has been around a very long time. They've been moved around, had multiple homes. It's sort of a legacy indigenous institution. All right. In New York, that if you go and look at their 990s going way back, there are periods where they had tons of money and then they had decline, right? They've been doing this like over the generations as these sort of social, political, cultural dynamics about whether people care about indigenous people or not has fluctuated, frank, just being very frank.
Yeah.
And so the organization, again, post-2020 world, like a lot of new interest in them and a lot of different conversations. And so we're asking, what do you actually really need? And so, of course, most foundations like, oh, you could do a there's a lot of program heavy. Okay, you should now go and do something. Our conversations with them over time, it was like, what you really just need is money for the organization to stabilize and exist and bring in the resources, et cetera. So we just funded the organization itself as a legacy organization and not demanding or expecting some kind of output and product and kind of extra labor to, because we had seen that happen and they needed something else. And that's what they communicated that we needed. And so that's what we were able to provide. So we have three different kinds of approaches to what we can fund. And so there's the largest branch we call Keep and Shape Our Places. So that's the capital project or something that is directly a place keeping, preservation, heritage conservation, et cetera, effort. So that's one branch, and that's where the majority of our grant making goes. A second branch we call evolving our institutions. So the institutional, like the systems change and or systems development work that's needed for the work to happen and to sustain, we can invest in the institution being healthy and having agency and power. And so that was where we consider that an institution that they're being resourced allows for other work and dynamics and things to happen. And then the third is we call promote greater engagement and understanding. And that is more the programmatic, like what is the public interface so that the person down the street or that lives in that community actually has access to the content, the programs, the places, et cetera, in a way that are connected to the public and not niche, right? The people that care about preservation or the someone that is going to show up, how do you actually expand that so that more people have the kind of the points of contact with the work?
Got it. Yeah.
Okay. I have my last question, which is like just our closer question, but I feel like just one really quick, just quick follow-up from the previous one is just, how have you found the job? Like you were skeptical before you took it. Mm-hmm. Now that you've been in it, find the work.
Yeah, the next week will be 3 years. So yes, I do enjoy it, absolutely. It is, I joke with people all the time, like giving my money is a lot harder than it sounds.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I believe that.
Rukaiya said that too. Yeah, Rukaiya.
It is. I mean, it's pretty horrible, actually. Mm-hmm. It changes all sorts of things about your, like whenever I go anywhere, I'm just a giant walking bag of money. I don't like going to parties.
That makes sense. I would totally be like you.
Yeah. It's like pretty sad. Yeah. But so that part is not nice. But and it's a lot of work. I've always had at least three jobs.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
So like the amount
like
of
Vanessa, like we have like all of a lot of jobs. Come on.
Yeah. So the amount of work is it's a lot of work, but that's not a problem. It's very rewarding because it was a new program. We're in a big established institution, as you could see, but it's like being able to have something that's new and we're like a startup almost within the organization. So it's very exciting. I'm pretty sure if I had been landing into something that was already set up in there, like I would be bored out of my mind. Pretty sure.
Yeah.
So it's been great to have that and to build a team and to be able to have that level of leadership role that it's new and generative in a way that resonates with me. So I really enjoy that part of it. And I would say that I've been very pleasantly surprised of how different it is from how I had previously experienced philanthropy. And I think it's because, again, with the leadership here, that we are actually being allowed to do things in a way that are different from the kind of the conventions for how philanthropy has conventionally operated. And so my fears about having to be in that space and world, which is still ultimately corporate. And this place, it is a corporation. We have quarters and targets and object, like that's still there.
Fancy boardroom.
Oh, this isn't even the fancy room.
It's got art. I don't know. It's like this beautiful,
it's got view of a carpet
garden. I don't know.
Yeah, yeah. No, this place is that's very great. Nice. But that energy is there. But we are allowed to really do the work, and I'm just so, I feel very lucky that we get to do that, and the amount of resource that we're able to direct to communities that really need it. I was skeptical that my explicit architecture design built environment background was going to be legible and tangible enough in the works. I'm also very pleasantly surprised that has been able to be something that I still get to express that in my work and identity here, which is really great. So I'm very happy to have done it 3 years in, and yeah, excited for work. The thing I didn't mention here, I actually have two jobs. So I run Humanities in Place, but I also work with the Monuments Project. So that's a presidential initiative. And I also have previous background in, I mentioned going all the way back to college when a little 19-year-old me is, what is up with these monuments?
That's
really cool. So I work directly on that project, which was initially a $250 million initiative as a 5-year, instead of a program, which is meant to be in perpetuity or indefinite at least, to a time and budget limited initiative. That was 5 years, $250 million. That was recently expanded to $500 million, so an additional $250 million. And so that work is something that I also do here at the foundation with colleagues in the president's office. Julie Ehrlich is the kind of director of presidential initiatives, so we collaborate on that work. And so getting to work on both of those has been really rewarding, because Humanities in Place is building a new path. Like, we sometimes even say this is just an entirely new field.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And things that certain disciplines, structured disciplines, are not doing well and ignoring, well, maybe we just need a new discipline. It's called Humanities in Place.
Yeah, I agree.
So that's the channel, and I really do enjoy it.
Oh my gosh. If we had more time, it would fall and be like, okay, now we need to know about and have everybody hear about all these cool projects that you're doing with taking from your earlier interests in monuments and now bringing it to life. But since we don't, I think the best way for me to spend the last few minutes of my final question is probably to help you out, is be like, also to help me out, and be like, so people aren't stopping you on the street and being like, hey, give me money. People listen to this. What is that process to ultimately getting there? How do people do that?
Yeah, so foundations all work in very different ways. Mellon, and it's kind of where it sits in the network, was a very elite space. So it was like a don't call us, we'll call you place, or through kind of networks and connections. So that was a legacy of the place, and that has changed significantly over time, and specifically during President Alexander's tenure, where there are more opportunities through things like open calls and just open grant-making relationships, and also very targeted, where we reach out to find people in places that don't even know that Mellon exists and wouldn't normally be in these sorts of networks. But in our program, the way that we've approached it is that anyone that has a project or idea, go to the Mellon website, mellon.org, and then you find Humanities in Place, and there's a place where it says submit an inquiry. So you click the thing and you could say, this is what I'm working on. This is what I'm interested in. It can't be an individual. So we're still a nonprofit charity. So we can only fund charitable projects and organizations. So you have to either be a nonprofit, or you have to have fiscal sponsorship or some mechanism or a partnership that can accept philanthropic charitable giving dollars. Very important point. So, you know, oh, I bought the so-and-so's historic house and I privately own it. We are not giving you money, just to be crystal clear. But if you have something that is aligned and everything's laid out pretty transparently on our website, the kinds of things we support, you can look at our blog posts and things that kind of illustrate the kinds of projects we do. Submit your inquiry, and our team, we review all of them. It takes some time because we get a lot of inquiries, but we review all of them. And if there's a line, you'll get a call.
That's Sounds pretty simple.
It's pretty awesome that you actually review all of them. I feel like whenever you're submitting to like grants or foundations, it feels like an into the void. I'll never hear again.
Yeah, we do actually. It takes time, but we actually review all of them.
That's amazing.
Yeah, we come from a place where we talk and have to interact with foundations all the time. That is not their process. Like, it is essentially about who you know, and it shouldn't have to be.
It takes some kind of work and bandwidth on our part to do that, but we've found that it's a really important shift for us to operate in that way. And definitely there are things that we research and find, and we reach out and do things that way too, because sometimes a lot of people don't know what Mellon is, or they may have like certain association with Mellon that is, you'll fund the opera or the ballet, but not my little scrappy conservation, conservation right? And so we work with our comms team and things to get eventually to get it socialized that we're there. But really, if somebody does hear, they can go on our website, go to the Mellon site or Mellon YouTube, and just see all of the different conversations and programs that are had with people in practice, with scholars, with kind of leadership in different spaces. It's really great. The foundation is, I think, it uses its great wealth and resource and kind of position to really push some really important conversations around justice and community and what that looks like.
Cool. Thank you.
Okay. Question. And this goes back to, you know, I'm taking off my problem solver hat and I'm putting on my human-centered and I'm
humanist humanities hat. Yes.
And I'll ask you to do the same. Is there a story in your heart that you wish more people knew about? The kind of story that like might become an Urban Roots episode one day, perchance. But what is the story in your heart you wish more people knew about?
Well, Deca knows this one already, but the history project that I always make a point for people to know about is, so I mentioned I'm from Indianapolis, and in that city's history, there is a Black community that had, I think, a really powerful kind of counter-narrative, counter-story to what we're taught about Black people in cities in America, like the urban renewal. Black people were put into an area and they tried and then they were wiped out and failure and harm. And that is very true, but there are other things that happened and occurred. And I cynically / truthfully believe that we're not told the counters to that story. Yeah. So I always wear my ring. So my ring is, it's not the actual ring because I'm afraid to lose the actual ring, but it's my grandfather's class ring, and he was a farmer. But what he actually did is he ran a very large-scale urban agriculture program in Indianapolis in the 1940s in this Black community that had programs where they grew their own food, they took care of their own health care and kind of community and social services, and they built their own self-built housing, affordable housing, ownership housing at a large scale, hundreds of homes, in an inner city neighborhood in Indianapolis. That is, to this day, that neighborhood still exists. It's still predominantly Black, still predominantly homeownership, an affordable neighborhood in the center of the city. So it was a success of Black people working together to address their kind of community and social needs. That's a different story from building public housing or destroying public housing or wiping out historic neighborhoods, et cetera, that predominates. And I think it's intentional that we don't know where and how people were successful. So I do hope that people keep saying, when are you going to write a book about it? I was like, I have no time. At some point, I will try.
Wait,
but
what's the name of the neighborhood?
So the organization is called Flanner House. So the neighborhood is the Fall Creek Homes neighborhood. So it's in downtown. There's Fall Creek is a creek that's there. They're very smart. Because the original homes would flood all the time because of the low-lying creek. And they rebuilt the neighborhood. They turned the part that flooded into a park and moved all the housing upland so it would be a resilient community. And people, it was before Habitat for Humanity, at least 20 years before Habitat for Humanity. They did what Habitat for Humanity is known for. They did it, but all Black people, and so that's why we don't know.
Yeah.
We know about Habitat for Humanity.
Right. I mean, it's interesting because when we went out to start to figure out what the stories might be around in terms of our Indianapolis episodes, I came into it first having a conversation with Lelia Bundles, right? So that was the direction, and then Indiana Avenue became the natural
But I truly think if we do follow up,
this is like a mile from Indiana Avenue.
Wow. Flanner House was something that we've definitely heard about. And I think, is this connected to some of the additional work that you do with nonprofits in Indianapolis?
Yeah.
Could you just like, Flanner House. The organization that you and your
Urban
family.
Patch. Yes. So the Flanner House is the organization that did this project. They've been around since the late 1800s, but they've been active and continue to be active in the community. But my grandfather, he was the head of the food programs at Flanner House. And so Urban Patch is where we did a legacy project to acknowledge like his work in history. And so we purchased vacant land and homes, more not in the Flanner House community, because that community is intact. It's the community where I grew up, which is a little further north. We buy vacant land and homes, and we rehabilitate them either as gardens and urban farms, and or as affordable housing, really using a model that there can be this sort of community-generated improvement that isn't dependent on either outside investment and or kind of gentrification models and pressures. So it's something we've been doing for number of years. I think 2010 is when we started that.
That's awesome. I remember when we talked about this just before, you're telling me your whole family's involved in this now, mm-hmm. and which I think is just so great.
I love that.
Yeah. Well, anyway, thank you so much.
You're welcome. Time. Yeah, absolutely. Thanks for making the field trip down here to,
this was fun.
To the Mellon offices.
We appreciate your time.
Thank you.
Yes, you're welcome.
Thanks for listening to this Urban Roots episode. And many thanks to our guest, Justin Garrett Moore. Your hosts are me, Dela Hussein Wetzel, and Vanessa Quirk. This episode was edited by us and mixed by Connor Lynch.
You can find us on Instagram at Urban Roots Culture or email us at urbanrootspodcast@gmail.com.
If you want to know more about Urbanist Media, the nonprofit that me and Vanessa are a part of and that produces the Urban Roots podcast, please visit www.urbanistmedia.org.
And because this podcast relies on support from our listeners, please consider donating to us via PayPal or Venmo at Urbanist Media. Okay, Deka, could you please hit the good people with our tagline?
Oh, yeah. Urban Roots. Looking back so we can move forward.